So often when you're dealing with a subject where there are many conjectures and few proofs, it is appropriate to philosophize. And so I will begin with some philosophy. It's appropriate because I know some people have had difficulty defining analytic number theory, or even deciding whether such a subject exists. But it does. It is a part of number theory that tries to understand the relationship between L functions and distribution of prime numbers. And of course, the prototype is the Riemann zeta function, which all of you are familiar with and have heard lots and lots about. So it tells you something about the distribution of rational primes and the relationship to the zeros in pole of this analytic object, the Riemann zeta function. But the point is, the Riemann zeta function alone does not tell us everything about primes. And for example, Riemann zeta function alone does not tell you about finer distribution of primes, say in arithmetic progressions, or primes in quadratic progressions, or primes with other constraints. So it's not that the zeta function tells you everything, even about rational primes. And in fact, there may be other constraints as well. Perhaps it is actually impossible to understand finer distribution properties of primes if you look at the zeta function in isolation, that is, as a single object. And certainly we've seen lots and lots of instances of this to justify this. In fact, I believe several of the courses here were about looking at families of zeta functions, families of L functions. The point is that you can get something out of the family that you couldn't get out of a single zeta function looked at, viewed in isolation. And in the courses here, which I unfortunately wasn't able to attend most of, I know you were looking at families of automorphic L functions. This talk is going to be about another family, maybe the same family or a subset, but these are L functions associated to continuous complex Galois representations, namely Artin L functions. And so the families we're going to look at are Artin L functions, that is, L functions in this that come from complex continuous complex representations of Galois groups of number fields. I'm going to restrict to number fields. But I think the philosophy of that you cannot understand fine distribution of prime numbers by looking at a zeta function in isolation is an important one, and one that will recur in many, many different ways. Has already in several ways, but will continue to do so. Okay, so let me just recall the context. So we have a finite Galois extension of number fields, K over F. Now, as the talk progresses, I just realized K and F will tend to get interchanged because this is not my usual notation. So often I forget which is the base field and which is the extension, but that will be the challenge for you to figure out what I'm talking about. Yeah, you see, the problem is normally you'd like to use E over F, but then if you use elliptic curves, you run into problems later on in the proof. So then one changes to K, but then K is often a ground field. Anyway, let it be as it is. So the fundamental problem is that you have a finite Galois extension, and I say I'm restricting to number fields for now, in this talk, in fact. And the problem that we're interested in is how are primes distributed in conjugacy classes. Of course, primes don't live in conjugacy classes, but there is an association from the set of primes to the set of conjugacy classes in G. By primes here, I mean prime ideal of F, prime ideal of the ring of integers of F. There is a way of associating an element, a conjugacy class in the Galois group, and one wants to know how those conjugacy classes, how the primes fit into those conjugacy classes. And the simplest example is when the ground field is Q and the extension is a cyclotomic field, then the conjugacy class, well, this is an abelian extension, so a conjugacy class is a singleton. And if you have a prime P, then the element of the Galois group that's associated to it is the automorphism that sends an mth root of unity to the eighth power. where P is congruent to A mod M. So this is a generalization of prime gene arithmetic progressions. And the second example, both of these are classical examples. Second example is if you have a monic polynomial with integer coefficients, irreducible, and let's say its Galois group is a full symmetric group, then the way that F factors mod P determines the Frobenius conjugacy class of P in what extension in the splitting field of F. So you have Q is the base field, and the splitting field of F is a big field, and the Frobenius conjugacy class of little p in that Galois group is determined by the way F factors mod P. And in fact, if it factors like F1 to Ft, where each Fi is of degree Ri, then the conjugacy class associated to P is the one in the symmetric group, which looks like, which has this cycle structure. Okay. There are also more modern examples, by the way, in which the Chebotaro density theorem is related to non-vanishing of L functions, but those are more sophisticated applications. Okay. So if you have a conjugacy subset of G, that means a union of conjugacy classes or a subset of G which is stable under conjugation, then you can ask for this quantity pi sub C of X, which is the number of prime ideals of the ground field, that is more precisely of the ring of integers of the ground field, that are unramified in the extension and whose Frobenius symbol or Frobenius class lies inside C. If C is a single conjugacy class, then you would say that the Frobenius thing is actually equal to C. Otherwise, it lies in C. And the Chebotaro density theorem, which was proved a long time ago, gives you the asymptotic of that, namely, essentially that primes are equidistributed, Frobenius symbols are equidistributed. The probability that Frobenius is in a given conjugacy class is just the size of the conjugacy class, the ratio of the size of the conjugacy class to the order of the group. Okay, so that's good. But to apply this in applications, and there are tons of applications, you need to have a uniform and effective version of this. And that means that little o of 1 in the previous error term is not good enough. It's good enough if your field is fixed and all you're worried about is the variance in X. But if you're in a situation where you want to apply this and the field is going to vary, then you have to know how that little o of 1 depends on constants of the field. And that's where L functions come in. These error terms usually, the fact that you're able to get an error term usually, not always, means that you know something about the zeros and poles of various L functions. And in this case, really, it boils down to the Dedekind zeta function, which is sort of the number field generalization of the Riemann zeta function. It's the sum in the half plane. It's given as a sum of over integral ideals, norm of A to the minus S. Okay. Now, you can ask, but I just state out of curiosity an interesting result of Rahm and Benjamin Zhu. That you can ask, you see there are elementary proofs of prime number theorems also, where you don't, in some sense, you don't use L functions at all. And you can write down such a proof. And now the question is, can you write down an elementary proof of the prime number theorem in a number field? And it turns out that it's not quite, but you'll need an assumption, namely that the integral ideals are distributed in the following way. That is, one knows that there should be some constant times x, but if you have an error term of x to the theta with some theta less than 1, then they show that you can make the rest of the proof of the prime number theorem is elementary. But, of course, knowing this bound, I don't know an elementary way of getting that bound, because that, I don't know an elementary way of getting that bound. But if you had one anyway, it would also give you information about the zeta function in the half plane, real part of S bigger than theta. Okay, well, elementary or non-elementary, you do know the analytic continuation of this Dedekind zeta function to the whole S plane. And apart from the pole at S equals 1, it is entire. It is analytic. The next step then is to know where the zeros are, and that's where the generalized Riemann hypothesis comes in. the GRH is the assertion that the non-trivial zeros are on the half line. Okay, so now assuming that you can get a non-trivial and effective version of the Shapataro density theorem, you can also get an effective estimate for the error term in the Shapataro density theorem without assuming the Riemann hypothesis, but it is very weak. It's very weak, and in applications, it's of limited use. I think there are some fundamental problems still that have to be overcome there before we have a usable version of the unconditional version. In any case, I will restrict myself to versions where we assume the Riemann hypothesis. So assuming the GRH, you have an estimate of this kind. This is due to Ligarius and Rodlisko. It's now quite old, more than maybe 25 years old. And what you should notice here is, of course, the x to the half that's coming from the Riemann hypothesis in the usual sense, the half here. And at first blush, it may seem that you got everything you want, namely you've got the good dependence on x. But the problem is these other things that are hanging around, the size of the conjugacy class, the degree of the base field. Was the base field F? So this is the base field. This should be the discriminant of the top field. Yeah, absolute value of the discriminant of the top field. And that's where the challenge comes in working with Shapatarov in effective versions and looking at its possible ways of applying it. This is where the challenge comes, managing these constants. They're constants in one sense, but the problem is in applications, we'll want to vary these fields. Actually, I should tell you that the real push behind using Shapatarov is, in fact, not to finite extensions, but to infinite extensions, where the splitting of primes is totally mysterious, a totally mysterious phenomenon. And so you attack it by trying to truncate the such problems at finite layers and apply Shapatarov in these forms. And then you try to let the layers go up to infinity. And for that reason, you need to know what happens when you let the layers go to infinity. And that's why you have to be totally explicit and effective in all the field constants. So that's the challenge, to do something about those constants. So that's, once again, that's the challenge, is to manage those field constants. The question that comes to mind first is, can we get rid of them altogether? Maybe there are no, maybe the error term doesn't depend on the field. That would be great. You can prove lots of nice theorems in that case. For example, could we expect something like this? I mean, after all, if we look at rational numbers, the number of primes up to x minus li of x is O of x to the half log x. Could that possibly be true in number fields? If it were, then lots of problems could be solved. But it's not even true for quadratic fields, unfortunately. Simply because, you see, if it were true uniformly like that, that would mean that you could get an absolute bound on the least prime that splits or doesn't split, least prime quadratic residue or quadratic non-residue, independent of the modulus, which is, of course, absurd. So there's no way that you can get a bound like that. So therefore, you're stuck with some dependence on the field in the error term. But how much dependence? This is, we don't know. And in fact, it's sort of a fundamental problem that has surprisingly received little attention so far in the general context. For example, is it possible that this kind of estimate could hold? Could the dependence of the field be as minimal as just the absolute value of the discriminant of the top field appearing in the logarithmic term? That would also be good. We could use that in lots of applications as well. But we're far, far, far from being able to prove anything like this. Yeah, actually, to tell you the truth, I haven't thought enough about contradicting it, but... So that's where this talk is really coming from, that to understand the error term, how much better it can be under any hypothesis. If zeta functions are supposed to tell you about error terms in prime number theorems, what is it about the zeta function or L functions that will give you a better error term? Okay, well, first, there are some things you can do already that weren't done by Lacarius and Odlyzko. Namely, the point is the Dedekind zeta function is not a primitive zeta function in the sense of Selberg. And now, I should hasten to add something that is obvious. By this phrase, the grammar may be not so good. I don't mean to suggest that Selberg is primitive, but I mean that the notion of a primitive L function in the sense introduced by Selberg. Dedekind zeta function is not primitive. It factors as a product of other L functions. This factorization is just the decomposition of the regular representation of the Galois group into irreducible characters. So you have a product indexed by the irreducible characters of a certain L function, which I'm not going to bother defining, but you can guess what it is. So this LS chi is the Artin L function, and it occurs with multiplicity equal to the degree of the character. So by the way, this tells you immediately that if you have a non-abelian group, the Dedekind zeta function does not have simple zeros on the half line. These L functions occur with multiplicity in the zeta function. Now, you know from many instances that in analytic number theory that when you have a factorization of zeta functions, you're always going to do better by working with the factors than with the product. So you try to exploit that. Now the Artin L functions, there's some analytic problems, of course. The Artin L functions have a meromorphic continuation, not known to have a holomorphic continuation. But the conjecture is that they are in fact entire apart from predictable behavior at S equals 1. And you can also ask about the Riemann hypothesis for LS chi. Actually, once you know the Riemann hypothesis for the Dedekind zeta function, you already know that the zeros of LS chi are on the half line. And you don't have to assume Artin conjecture even. Suppose you don't assume Artin conjecture. If you assume the Riemann hypothesis, then you know that all the non-trivial zeros and poles of LS chi are on the half line. And in general, the set of zeros and poles of LS chi, the non-trivial ones, are a subset of those of the Dedekind zeta function. I think you covered that in your course. Okay, so if you assume now the Riemann hypothesis for the Dedekind zeta function and Artin's conjecture on the holomorphy of these LS chi's, then you have this kind of estimate for the error term, where the important thing to notice is that the size of the conjugacy class has been replaced by the square root of the size of the conjugacy class. And I just remind you, GRH means Riemann hypothesis for the Dedekind zeta function of the top field, and AC is the Artin conjecture that the LS chi are analytic at S0(1). And also remark that we didn't do it in that paper, but you can essentially get this result without assuming the whole of Artin conjecture. It's enough to assume the Riemann hypothesis for the Dedekind zeta function, and an estimate for LS chi to the right of a half, of a, you know, some polynomial estimate. Doesn't matter what constant you put in here, some sort of polynomial estimate. That would be enough to prove slightly weaker version of the above estimate.
Isn't that like the
what?
There's a pole.
You're assuming Riemann hypothesis, so you know there's no pole to the right of a half already. You're not assuming that there are no poles on the half line. You love those. But if you know growth, just bound yourself away from the half line. If you have a polynomial growth, then you're happy.
Oh, wait a second. But that's uniform. It doesn't depend on epsilon.
It can depend on epsilon. I don't care.
That you sure. Said absolute.
Yeah. I should say.
In the implied context, it depends on
epsilon. Right. That's right. Yeah, otherwise you'd get holomorphy on the half line. So So these estimates, where you assume Artin conjecture or some version of it, or some weaker hypothesis on the Artin L function, is very useful if you're dealing with a problem where conjugacy classes are large. And that happens when you have a Galois extension which is very non-abelian, non-solvable, for example. The typical example, which you've seen perhaps before, is that arises in the Lang-Schroeder conjecture. So this conjecture tells you some. Actually, Lang-Schroeder conjectures are a whole collection of conjectures, not one conjecture, a whole collection of them. And it's remarkable that they made these conjectures with rather good heuristics, but limited numerical evidence. So the version that I'm thinking of is that if you have this cusp form, which is a normalized eigenform for the Hecke operators, and you look at its Fourier coefficients, and let's say that the Fourier coefficients are rational integers, then one of the Lang-Schroeder conjectures asks how they're distributed. How often do they take a fixed value? Now, you know that this includes the question of primes in quadratic progressions. So this question of Lang and Trotter is a generalization of the problem of primes in quadratic progressions. And the conjecture is that up to a constant, that is, it is a constant times root x over log x. Totally unapproachable in terms of the asymptotic. But you can try to get upper bounds, and people have done that. And the tool is the the fact that to this modular form, there are Galois representations, and one knows a lot about these Galois representations. So you want to attack the problem of how often a Fourier coefficient is equal to A. You actually have infinitely many infinite Galois extensions, one indexed by primes L. You chop off those infinite extensions at the finite layer and use that to get information about congruences. Instead of equality between AFP and A, you estimate this quantity, you get an upper bound for that quantity by the number of primes up to X such that A sub F of P is congruent to A mod L. Then you estimate that. And this is an example of what I was saying before, that you want everything totally uniform. So now you can choose your L as a function of X. And you do that, and you get, if you use the Laguerre-Sedlitzko estimate, you get x to the 7/8. If you use the c to the half estimate, you get x to the 4/5. So both of these, of course, assume the Riemann hypothesis. A priori, it would appear that this assumes Artin's conjecture, but in fact, you don't need to assume Artin's conjecture. So it's not that we can prove the c to the half estimate in the Chebotaro density theorem without assuming Artin's conjecture, but that in this application, we're able to circumvent the use of Artin's conjecture. So both of these depend only on the Riemann hypothesis. So you see the conjecture is like x to the half, and we're at x to the 4/5. So there are some defects in this kind of thing. Firstly, we're assuming powerful things. We're assuming Riemann hypothesis. And it's true, we didn't need Artin's conjecture here, but we're assuming Riemann hypothesis. And you'll find me sometimes saying, we get a result assuming only the Riemann hypothesis. So it's an indication of where we are, the frontier that we're at, where it's okay to assume the Riemann hypothesis. That's a small assumption. But the point is, even assuming this, you're nowhere near getting x to the half. You're getting something like x to the 4/5. If you assume an estimate like the one I suggested earlier, you know, that we had neither a reason to believe or disbelieve, this kind of thing where the dependence on the field is only here, then at least you can use it to get O of x to the half. And maybe if you're careful, even O of x to the half over log x, I'm not sure. But as I said before, we're far away from being able to prove anything like that. Secondly, what we gained by assuming the Artin conjecture doesn't help you if your conjugacy class is small. It only helps you if the conjugacy class is large, because you've replaced essentially the size c by c to the half. But if the size of the conjugacy class is 1, then you have this key fact that 1 squared is 1. And I want to emphasize this, because it is an important point. If you have an integer d, which is bigger than 0, and d squared equals D, then D is 1. It's amazing how really simple properties of numbers play a very key role, especially when you're trying to understand the generalization of theorems from Q to number fields. So the point is that often you'll find something that looks like that will make a difference. If D is bigger than 1 and it appears in something, then there's a big difference between D and square root of D. Whereas with D equals 1, you don't see the difference. Anyway, here in this context, the point is if your conjugacy class is a singleton, you're not going to see any difference. And this does arise if you're trying to count primes that split completely in number fields. And this is, for example, the situation that arises in the Artin primitive root conjecture. So this doesn't have much impact, or it doesn't help you too much in that kind of problem. That's another defect. Third thing is that these estimates don't completely reflect the intuition that if you have a big conjugacy class in a group and you're throwing, here's your group, and this is my favorite picture of a group, and here's the identity element, and then the rest is partitioned into conjugacy classes, some big, some small. Let's say, and you're throwing prime numbers into that group according to their Frobenius class, then if you've got a big class, it should be easier to hit this target than to hit this target. And so whatever version of Chebotarov you come up with, if you look at its implication for the least prime, the size of the least prime that hits a certain conjugacy class, or whose Frobenius class hits a certain conjugacy class, that should be sensitive to the size of the conjugacy class. Now, if you use the Lagerius-Odlyzko estimate, you get a bound. This is the bound that means whatever conjugacy class you choose, you can find a prime of norm less than this, whose Frobenius symbol will be that conjugacy class. It's a good clean estimate, but it doesn't depend on the conjugacy class. It doesn't reflect this fact, this intuition that we just said, that a bigger conjugacy class should be easier to hit than a smaller one. If you use the C to the half estimate, it's a little bit better. You see that the size of the conjugacy class occurs in the denominator. It's better, but probably still is not the truth. The truth is probably something like this. You have the size of the conjugacy class should actually be inside the square. And once again, when D is 1, D squared is D, you don't see any of this over Q. You don't see it even over a billion extensions. But this makes a difference if you're working with non-abelian extensions. Okay, so there's a big gap, as you can see, between what we can prove, or what we can prove assuming conjectures, and what the truth might be. And so we're still looking for a path to figure out what is the optimal bound and what is it about L functions that will lead us to that bound. Is there some finer information about zeros and poles, if they are, of Artin L functions that will give us a better estimate? So when you're coming across this and you've used the Riemann hypothesis, then the natural next candidate is to use something about the finer distribution of zeros on the line. Pair correlation is a natural candidate. Now, actually, if you look at pair correlation in the distribution of rational primes, you might say, well, that's not going to help you very much, because in fact it doesn't. In rational primes, if you have the Riemann hypothesis, you get an estimate like this. The error term is like x to the half log x, and if you assume a pair correlation conjecture, you can shave off a power of half in the log x. And you might say that's not a very significant improvement. Maybe it's not. But the point is, in the non-abelian setting, this kind, the analog of this improvement turns out to be dramatic. because maybe I should also here say that the error term in the prime number theorem, even the classical prime number theorem, you see, when you look at psi of x, can you see this? Should I put on? Psi of x is x plus O of x to the half log x squared. And from this, you deduce by partial summation that pi of x is Li of x plus O of x to the half log x. Now, this log x squared is an interesting term, because as you try to generalize this from Q to some spheres, you still get a log x squared, but it actually splits up into a log x and then a log term, which depends on the field in some way. Let's say I'm dealing with abelian extension, so there's no conjugacy class, and there's no, let's say, even cyclotomic extension. So you have a prime, say, a cyclotomic extension of conductor Q. Then you'll have a log Qx. So in other words, log x squared here, the two logs are not equal. And you don't see that over Q. You only see it when you go to a number field, that the two logs actually split up. One is an actual log, and another is a log together with some dependence on the field. Now, when you do this partial summation from here to here, what goes is this one. And you still have this. And now, if pair correlation replaces this by a square root, then you see that you have a chance of, if the log df is big, it's going to have a big impact. That's the heuristic. But on top of that, to make matters worse, there are also other stuff here, depending on the group. And the point is, all of this goes together. And so when you do the analog of this calculation that results, that takes you from log x to the half in a number field setting, it's all of this that gets, whatever is up here, times this, that gets replaced by a square root. And the result of that is that you end up getting a power of x saving, and not a power of log x in applications. And that is dramatic. So what I'm going to describe is joint work with Ram that we hope will write up soon. Most of it is written up. It's been written up for a while. It's just some touching up that has to be done.
By a certain co-op.
So the quantity then we're looking at is this analog of the psi function here. So psi sub c of x, which is a weighted sum over primes, whose Frobenius symbol is contained in C. Now, I wanted to use this word spectral decomposition, because I know you guys would like that. I'm just expanding it into characters. I have this kind of thing where psi x chi is a twisted version of that, where the character chi comes in. The sum is over irreducible characters chi of the Galois group. Okay, so now assuming that this L as chi is entire, that is assuming Artin's conjecture, and using the explicit formula, usual method of analytic number theory, you get this expression that psi x chi is delta of chi times x. Delta chi is 1 if chi is trivial and 0 otherwise. So there's a pole. The pole at s equals 1 coming from the trivial character gives you that term. And the rest is this sum is a sum over zeros of ls chi, and e is another error, sort of innocuous error term. That's sort of standard. And here's the innocuous error term, if you care. So even there, I didn't write down all the terms, because there are lots and lots of terms that come up, but they're not hard to estimate. One term that you have to be very cognizant of is A sub chi. A sub chi is the Artin conductor of chi. So it's the analog of the conductor of a Dirichlet character. Unlike the conductors of Dirichlet character, this thing grows exponentially. It grows fast. And it's often a real problem. It's defined like this. There's the discriminant of the base field, The absolute value of the discriminant of the base field raised to the degree of the character, and the norm of the conductor of an ideal. This ideal is determined in terms of primes. It's in fact supported where primes where chi is ramified. Ramified as a representation of the Galois group. In other words, that it's non-trivial when it's restricted to the inertia group at that prime. In terms of the degree. No, so that takes the easy terms. The hard term then is the sum over zeros. So let's introduce this sum STX, and basically what I have to estimate is this. This is what I'm getting in the error term. I have actually x to the half plus I chi over this, x to the half comes out, and it's this sum that I want to estimate in such a way as to take into account possible cancellations and oscillations. Okay, you can express it by this integral and then integrate by parts. You get this sum can be written in terms of that sum in a simple way. Now the pair correlation conjecture that we want to formulate for is to help us estimate this sum. And what we're doing here is, I guess I should say that gamma 1 is not gamma 2. I'm running over zeros, gamma 1, gamma 2 of height at most t, a certain weighting factor that comes up in the explicit formula method, and then exponential of this. I want gamma 1, not gamma 2. No, yeah, that's right. I have t log t, that's fine. Yeah, okay, that's right. Okay. And what the kind of estimate we need is this kind of estimate for the sum for y in some range like this. For some a, actually, it's enough to have it for some positive a. Now, the trivial estimate for this is if I were to square this term here. So what I'm asking for is the non-trivial condition here is that this term appears to the first power, not to the second power. Okay, it's completely analogous to the kind of pair correlation estimate one has over Q. So just to repeat, that's what we have, that's the conjecture. And if you use that in estimating STX, this is the estimate you get. Using one notation here, A chi of T means it's this expression that comes up repeatedly, log of the Artin conductor plus the degree times the degree of the base field times log T. So apply this in the formula for psi x chi, and subtracting off the possible main term and pulling out the x to the half, you have two error terms. This, I think, is what I wrote down before, and this is the innocuous error term. And applying now the estimate that we have for STX, what you deduce is an estimate for this, which is looks like this. Now, what you should notice is that if I didn't assume pair correlation, I would have had here log a chi. So the saving we have obtained by making this hypothesis on the oscillations of the zeros is that the log of the Artin conductor is replaced by this to the square root of that. And as I said, the dot dot dots mean there are hundreds of other little terms that you have to keep track of, but they don't really cause any problems. Now, we apply this to go back to psi sub c of x, which is what we're interested in. So a really useful identity is the one that's written in the second line there. Namely, if I take psi sub c of x and remove the main term, and then take the mean square, but weighted according to the size of the conjugacy class, then I have this sum over characters, the mean square of these twisted size. It's like a Plancherel formula. So now if I use the estimate of the previous slide for the psi x chi, remember we had the square root of log a chi there. So I take the mod squared and average over chi and get this kind of sum. Now how big is this sum of log a chi x? Remember log a chi x means it's log of the Artin conductor plus this thing. By the way, a sort of intuitive way of thinking of log of Artin conductor is roughly like this, not exactly, but it's this times a small logarithmic term which is supported at primes where chi is ramified. So at first blush, if you want to understand how this behaving, you can replace it with this. And in fact, one has an explicit estimate right here, that log a chi is this times log m, and this is what I just said. It's a quantity which is defined in terms of ramified primes, and much smaller in general than the discriminant. Now, how big is this log a chi? Using this estimate, putting it in here, you see, therefore, log a chi x is like chi of 1 times the degree times log mx. Okay? If you want to ignore the log mx first, you just have chi of 1 times kq. Well, if I sum the character degrees, not the squares, but the actual character degrees, if I sum the squares of the character degrees, I get the order of the group. But if I just sum the character degrees, how do I estimate that? Well, for a particular group, you might know some technique for estimating, but in general, the only thing I could think of is to apply Cauchy-Schwarz. And so what you're going to get is a sum of the chi's will be the number of characters to the half times the sum of the squares to the half. The sum of the squares is the order of the group. So that gives you this, but now you've got this new thing, which is the number of characters to the half. And of course, the number of characters is the same as the number of conjugacy classes. Okay, therefore, putting this all together, what we find is that this mean square, psi cfx minus c over gx whole squared, weighted by the size of the conjugacy class, is bounded in this manner. There is the x, the fact that this is x means we've assumed the Riemann hypothesis. And the fact that you have this here means we've assumed pair correlation. Now do a dumb thing and just take a single term from that. I don't know any better way of doing this. Do the dumb thing of just taking a single term and you get this estimate. So I take a single one, this is a sum of non-negative quantities. So I take a single one, then it's bounded by all of this to the square root times c to the half. Maybe actually I can even put a half here, but it's okay, let's not worry about that. And so now I have this a new estimate. Before, remember, with Artin's conjecture, I just had this. Riemann hypothesis is here, Artin's conjecture is here, pair correlation is here. What is this G sharp over G? Well, G over G sharp is the average size of a conjugacy class, because it's the sum of the sizes of the conjugacy classes divided by the number of them. That's an average size of a conjugacy class. And because it's occurring as G sharp over G, it's in the denominator. The average size, you're going to save the average size of a conjugacy class to the fourth power, to the 1/4 power. Be nice if we could save it to the fourth power. And so to summarize, this is what we've got. That if you assume GRH, Artin's conjecture, and this version of the pair correlation conjecture, you get this estimate for pi cfx minus the main term. Now, if you apply this to the Lang-Trotter problem, as the one we were discussing before, using the same notation, remember we had 7/8 from Lagerius-Odlyzko, 4/5 from our result, and now if you, and both of those assumed only Riemann hypothesis. Now, if you assume Riemann hypothesis plus pair correlation, you get 2/3. So you're still not at a half. But you saved, I mean, the change is a power of x, not just a log. And as I say, that is an important thing to notice, and I think you'll see much more of that when you go into number fields, that this phenomenon that for number d is bigger than 1, and d squared tends to be bigger than d. Okay, it's also instructive to see what this implies for the size of the least prime in a conjugacy class. Before, we had a bound that didn't have this, basically, if you just assume Artin's conjecture and the Riemann hypothesis. And now you're dividing by the average size of a conjugacy class to the square root. Now, if you're in a group where most conjugacy classes are of the same size, and let's say it's non-abelian, so this is interesting, make it interesting. No, not that the abelian case is not interesting, but I mean from this point of view. Let's say you're in a situation where you're a non-abelian situation where you've got conjugacy classes which are roughly of the same size, then what you've got is a bound for the least prime in the conjugacy class that looks like this. Remember, the conjecture I said that might reflect the truth is something like 1 over c squared log df squared. So we're inching towards that, but we're not there yet. And finally, let's go back to a classical problem. See its implications, the Artin primitive root conjecture. So this is a problem that asks how often an integer that that is not a square or 0 or 1, I guess maybe plus minus 1 do you have to exclude it? Yeah, plus minus 1. How often is it a primitive root mod p? In other words, how many primes is it the case that A generates the residue class as mod p? For example, how often is 2 a primitive root mod p? And the conjecture is that it is a positive density of primes depending on A. The best, Ram has lots and lots of unconditional results on that. But if you assume the Riemann hypothesis, there is this result of Hooley. Riemann hypothesis in this case is for zeta functions of Kummer extensions. Then you get that, yes, indeed, that's the main term. And then you just barely win. You just barely get the asymptotic formula. Other term is x log log x squared over log x squared. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't expect that the error term couldn't be as good as half plus epsilon. Is that a reasonable conjecture? Yeah. It's not an unreasonable expectation then that the error term should be a lot better. And as far as I know, this is the first time you see a possibility of actually making it better by a power of x. So if you assume the Riemann hypothesis and this version of the pair correlation conjecture, then you get in the error term an exponent less than 1, namely 10 over 11. You don't need to assume Artin conjectures in this case. Let me just sketch the outline of the proof. As I said, it involves Kummer extensions. So you have a typical Kummer extension. It's Galois over Q, that's the semi-direct product. I want to thank Wentong for showing me how to make the symbol. And Artin conjecture is known for this, because this is a monomial group. It has a non-abelian character, but it's a monomial character, so there's no problem with Artin's conjecture. Remember, I pointed this case out to you before, that it's a situation where you're looking for primes that split completely in an extension, and so all those improvements of the size of the conjugacy class don't help, because the conjugacy class is 1. So even if you replace c to the epsilon, it won't help. But now the point is, there exists a non-abelian conjugacy class in this group. And now with this pair correlation thing, you've got in the denominator the average size of a conjugacy class. And this non-abelian conjugacy class is big enough that it dominates all the other ones and therefore gives you a saving. So here I sort of indicated that, yeah. So you've got about m conjugacy classes. M minus 1 are just one element conjugacy classes, but then there's one heavy conjugacy class. which is as big as, roughly as big as M. That means the average size of a conjugacy class is M. You might say do the math, but we've been doing math all for the whole hour, but anyway, do the math here. You'll see the size of an average conjugacy class is M. So therefore you save an M to the minus fourth here. So now you do the way people look at ardent conjecture problem, you do an inclusion exclusion N sub A. To say that a prime is a primitive root, that A is a primitive root mod P, means that P does not split completely in any of these Kummer extensions associated to A. So therefore you do an inclusion exclusion in this way, and now the whole problem is to keep the sufficiently good bounds on the error so that you can do this inclusion exclusion in a non-trivial way. Well, if you remove the main term and then use the estimate that was on the previous screen and truncate at some point y, yet to be determined, you get an estimate like this. Of course, y to, we had a 1 over m to the quarter, so obviously you're going to get a y to the 3 quarters there. And as usual with Artin's conjecture, you have to use your, you know, every trick you can think of to figure out what to do with the tail. So from y to x, you interchange the summation again, and you interpret the tail in terms of prime divisors of some small powers of A. In this case, the powers go up to x over y. And then you bound that in a trivial way. Nothing is trivial, in an elementary way. And you get this bound. You try to set the two equal, the bound we had on the previous page, and this one. This one at the bottom here, and this one, and you see that y to the 6 over 11 will optimize, and you get an error term of x to the 10 over 11. So I think that's sort of that's a kind of interesting result in itself. Those two results, namely the improved exponent in the estimate for Langtrotter and the improved error term in the Artin primitive root conjecture, because they're winning powers of x, it sort of it tells you some new phenomena here in the study of pair correlation in a non-abelian setting, which I think makes it very interesting. Some remarks then to finish up. So firstly, pair correlation conjecture was of that kind. We don't need an asymptotic formula or anything like that. We just need this O bound. And we need to know it for some value of A, not every value. Also, the remark I've already made that the trivial estimate is weaker than the conjectured estimate only by power of log. But of course, as you know, logs can be, saving a log can be everything. Bombieri-Vinogradov theorem is only stronger than the trivial estimate by a power of log. And finally, a remark here that this has to be investigated a lot more, because it's not clear to me that the Riemann hypothesis is necessary. In fact, Rahm and Zaharescu have a paper where they formulate pair correlation without the Riemann hypothesis. And so it would be interesting to see what it means in this context. And then it's possible that we might start to get an unconditional version of the Chebotarov that is actually usable. I'm not trying to say that the existing one is totally unusable, but it's just so limited that in many applications it breaks down at a very early stage. And it's possible that this kind of hypothesis can help make it more useful without assuming the Riemann hypothesis. I think that's it.